Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
In this episode, we're going to look at a practical experience, a practical case of local economic development in a rural community in South Africa. I'm talking with John Lawson, who is a specialist in local economic development, a facilitator with many years of experience in the field, and who has been working in the province of Limpopo, which is in the northern part of South Africa in the recent past, and that is why we came across this rural place. Hi, John.
Hi, Jörg.
Good to have you on our program. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about this place, Vetakgomo?
Vetakgomo is a very rural area in the Limpopo province. It is measured as one of the poorest areas in the country, where there's very little infrastructure, which is in the tribal land areas where there isn't land ownership yet. So it's one of the areas where there's the lowest levels of education and the poorest of the poor. And part of the assignment was to find out whether LED could add value to these people in the area. But this was part of a larger project which also looked at neighboring municipalities, district or regional municipalities, and also the role of the province, all at the same time, and looking at coherence in LED strategy.
So that is one of the points that we definitely need to look at. But maybe let's first start by describing a little bit what kind of place that is. So what kind of size are we looking at? How many people living there? What is the state of local government? So how many people are working in local government?
The local municipality was only established in the year 2000, and they now have a total of 12 people working in the municipality. However, in the municipal area, you cannot see any visible town. When we're out there, you would drive anywhere and you wouldn't know where the town is. You wouldn't know where to stop. You wouldn't be able to find the municipal offices because it was so small. So it's very sparsely populated, but yet there are probably in the area of 130,000 people living in that area, mostly subsistence farming and bringing income in from other areas, depending on social grants, and very little economic activity going on.
So what was then the starting point to look at economic opportunities if there's not much that you can build on in that location?
We got the assignment and were told to look at the particular municipality, and frankly, when I saw it for the first time, immediately my fears were there is nothing, that there may be a good chance that we find no opportunity. And that would be very difficult to do a strategy other than suggest that you don't do anything in the area. But once we started digging deeper, we found that there was substantial opportunity in that the area, for example, is very rich in minerals and has some of the world's richest platinum reserves, which is very, very close to the surface. So there is latent potential for economic development, and actually there were quite a few things that were happening already. So there were potentials which were not apparent initially.
So that is like natural resources which are available in the location, but they aren't really exploited as yet, or has this whole platinum exploration boom already reached into this municipality?
Well, as we started digging in there, the initial interviews suggested that there was a single mine. We knew there was one platinum mine that we could start working with. And when we started digging deeper, we found out that the mine was just about to expand, that they already had planned and budgeted 2 billion rand worth in investment, and to increase the investment in developing that mine and increasing the employment by 150%. And suddenly, with this massive investment coming in this particular mine, one started exploring the consequences and opportunities relating to the mine.
Now, what we've seen in many other places is that this kind of thing happens. There's a big investor that is coming in that is pretty much pulling all the inputs, lots of the manpower, most of the resources they need from outside the local community. So how did that work out in this case?
By starting some dialogue with the mine manager, and as soon as the mine manager understood what our objectives and goals were, we probed or prompted the mine manager to help us think and find out what could be done for the local area. And in a matter of 1 minute, he rattled off 40 opportunities. Simple things such as once the rock in the bottom of the mine has been exploded, somebody's got to take the rock out. So they could outsource the movement of the rock, getting it out of the mine, transporting it by trucks, a multitude of things, even up to gardening, painting, maintenance of building houses, maintaining electricity. The guy rattled off 40 opportunities in a very, very short distance, and became very evident that most of these opportunities would not be exploited unless there was additional effort to make it happen. But this was not the only constraint. The town was located about 20 kilometers away from the mine, and the staff of the mine, mostly, especially looking at middle and high management, the high income employees, actually live 120, 130 kilometers away, where they can buy a house and live and get proper education and commute every day, which is not ideal for the staff living there. But it immediately indicated that there were some failures and obstacles in terms of why people weren't utilizing the town that was close. The most obvious one was that there's 20 kilometers of road that connected the town to the mine was in such poor condition that nobody traveled to the town. And this was something that the state could respond to quite quickly. The other issue was the fact that nobody could own land because it's still a tribal land system. The town or the city could not provide service land and sites for people to invest and establish, for example, suppliers to the mines to establish and be located much closer to the particular mine to service it. So there were very clear constraints which were the result of the state, the issues from the state and systemic issues which were constraints which this little local municipality couldn't address by themselves. They didn't have a budget, they had a tiny budget, and they couldn't respond to it, and they had dependence on many other public sector role players, such as the road agencies that build the road, such as the Department of Land Affairs that needs to change the regulation for the land and make the land available. And in that case, we then realized that local economic development in a particular area like that requires the state and the different players in the public sector to be able to work together in a coordinated manner so that the road agencies, for example, understand where the economic opportunity is, and when they decide where they invest and build roads, that it should be informed by an economic development rationale. So we then started working at how do you do this.
So, John, what you're aiming at is a kind of situation, a kind of constellation where the latitude of action for local government per se is kind of limited because of very limited resources, very few people, so that their only chance of achieving anything is to pull in all sorts of other agencies. Now, one of the things we know from many locations is that all sorts of government agencies from provincial and national level are doing all sorts of things without even informing local government about their existence. So how do you address something like that?
Because we had the opportunity of working with local municipalities, district or regional municipalities, which is a high level, and at the province at the same time, we had the opportunity of developing a bottom-up approach that we initially looked at the local municipal needs and opportunities and determined the priorities for Fetekhomo in this case. And a month later, we took these strategic priorities up to a district LED participatory planning session, which we prepared five local municipalities to compete basically for investment from public investors. We coined the term public investors, and it's picked up and it's run through the country. We, just in terms of explaining, a public investor, we see any public sector organization that will build assets in a particular area, whether it's building dams or irrigation systems or doing tourism initiatives. If people are investing in a particular space, we see them as public investors. So we rounded up a large number of these public investors, and they participated in our workshops. Essentially, we prepared the local municipalities and the different sectors to communicate in a very brief and quick way to these public investors what their priorities were. In a two-day session, actually 1.5 days, which was like a mini investment conference, these public investors understood what the priorities were and gave verbal commitments that they would provide support. And, of course, we recorded these and we followed them up. So after the district-level sessions, the district strategy was then also escalated up to a provincial level, where quite a couple of Fetekhomo's issues then became provincial priority issues to chase in economic development.
Now, does that mean that you would expect in a situation like that, typically, that other agencies, provincial departments or other government bodies come in and say, look, we have this amount of money, but we don't really have clearly defined priorities, and you give us a portfolio of opportunities, and then we choose what we find is the most convincing proposal? Don't they come in with their own plans, and then you have to convince them and talk them out of that and convince them that there's other priorities that are much more important than those they thought of?
Yes, definitely. As they come originally and they start participating, they come with their own budget and own mindset, thinking that they're doing great favors. But after a little bit of dialogue, and we're fortunate to work in a context where our president states that contributing or solving the problems around poverty is our national, the most important thing to do, and that all the public sector organizations need to contribute towards this, we've had a 100% success rate in convincing these agencies that their own success will be enhanced tremendously. Not only will they be able to meet their own performance criteria more accurately and better, they would meet it and not have the difficulty of local stakeholders fighting with them, both in our government structures and elections, and also in the political structures, for them not delivering or working on what the locals perceived as different issues. So if they avoid a lot of risk, they also save a huge amount of time, because they can make their decisions about where the best places are for them to invest with information that is prepared in a fairly solid way, which they don't have to go and redo the research. We have, for example, the road agencies will research the economy and then come up with their own opinions, and water affairs would do it, and forestry and tourism, and we would have 12 different government departments all repeating the same type of research. Actually, it doesn't need to be done so free by all of them. Somebody in the local area needs to understand what's going on in their local economy, make sense of it, and get these people in just to understand it in a brief way, and they can respond to it. So bottom line for them is they take less risk, they get a much higher return on their investment in terms of what their performance criteria are that they're reporting, and they save about 80% of their time in terms of deciding where they spend this. So they like it.
Now, there's a couple of things that are implicit in what you're saying. One of them is that you need a very strong commitment, a really strong leadership at the local level. And, well, you need a kind of commitment to development rather than having these kind of discussions of the type, is rather Cuba or China or some other country the model for South Africa, and should we go the communist or the capitalist way?
Yeah, it was quite a moving experience for me to go and work with these people. The name Feta Khomo is actually a black name for saying this is the place of resistance, this is where the freedom fighters come from, and they still believe that they are communists, but they understand that they are poor and they're looking for ways to respond to this poverty. And of all the assets that we found in the Feta Khomo area, the biggest was the leadership, the fantastic leadership in terms of being ethical, of being genuinely concerned about making progress, and the social capital that existed there was phenomenal, as I haven't found anywhere else in South Africa. And there was this great leadership, not very highly educated, but solid leadership, was so open to learning and collaborating and responding to identify opportunities to improve themselves. We had, because the education levels were not that high, we had to eliminate all economic terms, etc., and we had to do a little bit more work to help them understand and develop the insight of the local economy. But the leadership was great, and it permeated through to all their staff. For example, somebody who looked after the facility, we needed to set up a meeting on a Saturday. And the person that was supposed to open the locker to have the job, which was like a clerical job at the municipality, insisted in driving 120 kilometers just to do it, because it was her job to open and close it instead of giving the keys to us, because she took pride in her job. Now, whereas it might sound stupid, it's an ethic which we're lacking and short of here in South Africa and Africa. And to find it in this particular place, it made LED and our efforts a lot easier.
Now, looking at what you just said in terms of not such a strong level of education, not such a strong understanding of theoretical concepts among those local people, how do you then proceed to take them through a process where they actually define what their priorities are, and that they define priorities which make sense from an economic perspective, but also from a poverty alleviation perspective.
Yeah, I used the normal principles that MISA Partner promotes, except we tailor it a little bit for the South African context. And this was a real test of seeing to what level can we take these principles. I think the largest difference was starting and engaging with a point of building their learning and understanding from their frames of reference. They didn't have economic constructs. They didn't know what a sector was. They didn't know of anything that was out there. So we started off in dialogue and question and building models of their local economy. And simply by asking questions, first of all, asking questions about business and making them understand that business needs to make a profit to survive, and that if they're not making a profit, they wouldn't invest in that particular area. So we established that bit of foundation that was simple for them to understand. They could relate to it because they had friends who were involved in business, even small businesses. And then we started talking about, you know, what types of businesses are and how many people are there, and how does one deal with a group at a time? You give it a name, okay, let's call it a sector. And we used the cards. We mapped cards on the floor. We mapped the model of the local economy. Who are all the people in that area? And because the economy was small, it was quite easy to do. And we described it in ways that made sense for them. So we didn't use normal terms, but we described it in terms that they could relate to. We put a boundary around it to make it look like a system. And we started asking them about the relationships and how the money flows amongst these things. And then asked them and said, if this is a balloon or the leaking bucket concept of saying, where does the money come from? How does it come in? And then slowly went through the reasoning of how the money comes in and also what money goes out. And then also started exploring the concepts of the different sectors of, you know, is retail what it's all about, or are there some other key drivers? And then slowly started drilling into and finding out now, why do people really live in this area, and what are the options for growth? It's not about continuing the internal stuff. It's about bringing, first of all, trade in from outside and also investment in from outside. I think the most important principle is to start to find out where they are at, what their frame of reference is, and to start building up from there and not use any very technical terms.
How much time did you spend on that? So was that one workshop or a series of workshops plus some interviews, and how much time did you put into that?
We started off by doing, we called it leadership training. We got all the mayors and councillors and municipal managers, and we trained them all basically in Lokati. That was a two-day Lokati version to give them the basic principles, understand what LED is and what it is not. We then spent 2 days with the LED managers and the IDP, or the heads of planning departments, to understand just the basics of their roles. The first thing we did was build a model of their economy, let them understand what is an economy, and then started looking at what is your role in terms of development. And the basic principles, you know, what are you good at, what are you not good at, and who are the best people to do different roles, etc. So we spent 2 days preparing the key people that would be the core team for the rapid appraisal participatory type of work. We did some of the data work and building the profiles of what's happening in the economy and gave them some feedback. And then we did a rapid appraisal in 5 days flat. After that rapid appraisal, we then took Fetekhomo's issues up to the district level, where at the district level we had a 2-week participatory planning exercise where we brought the local municipalities, the sectors, and the different public investors together.
Maybe let's move back to what you've explained earlier, this relationship between the local actors, the municipality, and other public agencies that come from provincial level or national level. To what extent is what you've been doing an exercise around vertical relationships, where the local government presents its proposals to higher level agencies? And to what extent is it something where you can also then connect horizontally the higher level agencies, so that they actually work supporting each other, complementing each other, rather than having all their own logic and their own approach that may or may not add up to something that is actually useful at the local level?
Yeah, we've only had success in terms of trying to get the integration in a vertical level. We are working primarily with one department at the provincial level is responsible for local economic development, and some of the other departments see it as competition. I mean, now in a later program, we are exploring how to connect it at a horizontal level, and we found ways of doing it. But during the Fetekhomo case, all we were trying to do was to get high-level support, and it was outside the scope to actually start getting the synergy across the different public investors, except for one point that we had all the public investors in the same room, all debating and reasoning of saying what is the best for this particular region. And they all started sharing and understanding the same concept of view, and they all heard what the different main priority initiatives were and what the other public investor departments were pledging and supporting. So at least they were then informed about what the others were doing in a informal and dialogue situation.
Could you give us a feeling how much time has passed since you started with this whole exercise, and whether there's anything in terms of practical results, tangible results that is coming up already?
If we look at Fetekhomo, the biggest bottleneck was we came up with 7 priority initiatives, just 7 simple ones. The most important one was the road that needed to be built, 20 kilometers of road. We put a deal together that the South African National Road Agency, it's a national agency, had funding, and they had wanted to come and engage with the municipality, but they just couldn't put the act together. So they have agreed to do it, and they have adapted their budgets, and the road is being built, and it will be completed this year. We started the planning with Fetekhomo approximately 15 months ago, and since then, the road agency, we put the deal together, and the road agency is committed to do it, and they've started work already. In terms of the land ownership issues, we took it up from Fetekhomo to the district level, where it became a district issue, and pointed out that it could help hundreds of thousands of people and make a difference of billions of rands of capital growth if people could own their homes and property. This issue then was taken up at a provincial level, and it was taken right through to a national level and reprioritized. One of the ministers at the provincial level has taken on, and as she is the champion now, to drive for change.
Well, you could just quickly explain who's the owner of the land now. Is it government?
Large areas of land in our country was originally in the culture, in the black cultures, the owner of the land was a chief. And it was the chief's prerogative to allocate land to anybody, and they could take it away at any time. So you would not argue with the chief, because he could move you. You could build your house and you could lose everything you have just when he decides that he doesn't like you anymore or support you anymore. The state then introduced a change to the land, saying that they took the ownership away from the chiefs, and they made the chiefs the custodian of the land, but the land for formal transactions belongs to the state. So currently it belongs to the state, but there are 4 obstacles in order for ownership to change. The first one is the chief. If the chief says no, then change doesn't take place. So the chief are now acting as gatekeepers, because if they sit on it long enough, the mines bribe them to actually get access to it. So we find that the wealthy organizations get access to land, but the poor don't. And essentially what we're looking for is pro-poor growth. So they supporting poverty and they're acting as gatekeepers. Not all the chiefs, but many of them. When we looked at the amount of value that could be unlocked in terms of billions of rands, and we looked at the value of the bribes, because we could determine it, it was absolutely pathetic how small the bribes were, that we then decided that actually maybe the chief should get a commission, and we suggested it, and it was considered that they should be investment facilitators in order to get paid for bringing investment in. And it was interesting that by engaging with the chiefs, we found out that the chiefs were completely harassed totally the whole time by investors, and they would chase them away because they don't have enough time in the day to help them understand where to invest, because they're not getting a salary and they're not getting paid for it. So it's not in their interest to promote investment at all, other than they should actually care for their people and let them in, but actually they're harassed. So there's plenty of economic potential, and the chiefs are the first bottleneck. If the chiefs approve, then the municipalities need to approve. If the municipalities approve, then the province needs to approve. Once the province needs to approve, the minister of the country needs to physically sign for every land transaction, every single one. This takes a long time. It's impossible, and it's actually just rubbish. So we're challenging the whole fundamental system. Now, whilst it may be obvious that it should change, the question is now, if it is such a stupid system, why does it persist? And it's a political motive that the current political party and leaders are nervous that the traditional leaders and the chiefs can exert so much power, because so many uneducated people may feel threatened that they lose their houses, that they could have major loss in votes and support. They fear it. So what we did at a district level, we explored and found out to, you know, just a little bit of a survey, and it's about 98% of the population want the system to change. So if you had the concept of democracy, of course everybody wants to own their property. They can then raise capital. There are all kinds of issues that we have because they would then have an asset. What is interesting, the area that we're working with, because it is one of the resistance areas, it's at the heart of the party, of the ANC. And because it's the heart of the party and people now rebelling against this tribal land system, we're optimistic that something may change over the next couple of years. There were quite a few other issues, such as Fetekhomo was not on a map. You couldn't find it, and there were no road signs there. So essentially, they didn't exist. There were other signs, and we thought it was called Apple. So we asked them, who are you? And it's actually quite a beautiful area, and they've got some tourism opportunities and things. And anyway, this is one of the things, is just they need to be on a map. And to get on a map, they needed their road to be classified as a certain grade of road, and this was quite easy for them to do, which then when maps were drawn up, they would be physically located on a map. So they've had the road graded. That's one that's been implemented. Another one was just the signage. The road signage has changed. So there's been quite a lot of progress. I think one of the things that the people enjoyed the most was the capacity building. The LED manager was a maths teacher. He had no economics background. He was a maths teacher. But he had a wonderful attitude. If I was slow in my work with him, he would tell me I was wasting his time. That remind me of the objectives I set for him, and that actually we would be spending our time better if we did differently. So a wonderful man, but no other background. We had him facilitating from the second mini workshop he was facilitating. He had no formal facilitation training or anything. He had done schooling, etc., but he picked up the methodologies and was... So he facilitated quite well. His confidence grew tremendously, and he did well. But as soon as he did well and performed, he was picked up, and the Fetekhomo municipality then lost him. So these areas have got a great, great difficulty of keeping good people. Anyway, but the implementation, things have gone quite well.
Maybe to wrap up this conversation, what is going to happen next, or what are your plans in terms of further activities with that location, with that municipality, and looking at the bigger scale?
Yeah, what we have at the moment and are working on is a much larger program helping and supporting most of the municipalities in Limpopo. There are a total of 31 municipalities, and we have a program in supporting all of them. What we're trying to do is establish a common pattern of working with them and the public investors, that they can systematically and in a structured way engage and interact with each other. We've developed some models and particular ways of doing LED, and it's gone down well, and people are pursuing the concepts quite well. But what we're doing further is we're doing training, not just providing theory or model of how to do things, but we're training, we are demonstrating how to do certain parts of LED. We are providing coaching. We're establishing toolkits. So there's quite a comprehensive capacity building program that is now progressed after those initial pilot projects that we did. And as it relates to Fetekhomo, they're getting some more capacity building and support and coaching to help them get to the next level of maturity, to systematize LED instead of it just being a one-off event.
Maybe what we should mention is that your work is supported to some extent by the European Union, which is sponsoring a major LED program in Limpopo.
Yes, basically, Eurekina is the agency that got the contract to implement the EU program in Limpopo. It's called Limpopo LED, and which is housed by the Department of Local Government and Housing, Province of Limpopo.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Thanks for sharing this great story with us.
It's a pleasure, Jörg. Thanks very much for the great work and support over the years.